Welcome to the 24/7 Sports College Football Podcast with your hosts, Chip Patterson and Barton Simmons. The ultimate insider's guide from signing day to the national championship game and everything in between. CBS Sports presents the 24/7 Sports College Football Podcast.
And welcome back to the 24/7 Sports College Football Podcast. I'm Chip Patterson. That's Barton Simmons. We have an absolutely huge show. This is a record-breaking show. I don't think that we've had five guests on a single show before, but we're going around the world. We're going to be hitting five huge schools, checking in with the most important questions. We're going to be going to USC, to Georgia, to Texas, to LSU, to Michigan, getting the answers from the boots on the ground thanks to 24/7 Sports. Barton, the squad showed up. We're excited about that. But before we get to the fun, we need to dive into the news of the day as we sit here recording on Thursday, August 23rd. Let's get right into it. Urban Meyer suspended three games. He is going to be allowed to participate with the team in practice and preparation after the Oregon State game. So totally suspended from team activities from when he was placed on administrative leave until after the Oregon State game. As the we can hit the press conference, we can hit the fallout. I think there's probably maybe like three big ways we can hit this. Where do you want to go first?
I'm glad we're talking the morning after. As I got called on to HQ last night, and I reacted to this, and I always hate reacting immediately to things like this because I'm a slow thinker, and I need time to digest and really let it sit and simmer and figure out sort of what I think about this stuff, because I do think there's it's a mistake to at times to make sort of these huge, you know, damning statements one way or the other following things like this. So now that I've got some time to digest this a little bit,
that's what this podcast is here for. You and I get called on to CBS Sports HQ for our instant in the moment reactions, but that's because video clips, you know, like video hits need to be between 90 seconds and 2 minutes. This is a podcast where we have the entire landscape to be able to play this out. This is what the people subscribe for.
We can let it breathe a little bit on here.
Yeah.
You know? So, look, I was surprised, not surprised. I mean, I look at the beginning of this thing, I predicted it would be a suspension. And then I sort of backed off of that and figured, you know, and changed my mind at different points. But when it got down to it, like, in a way, a suspension is a half measure that doesn't make sense to me, really. Like, either you're going to say, look, we stand behind Urban Meyer. We either don't believe the accusations that were levied against Zach Smith in terms of the domestic violence, or we don't believe that Urban Meyer knew the information that would have merited a firing. And we stand by Urban Meyer, and this is an unfortunate situation, but he did no wrong and he's back. Or you say, we are disappointed in the way Urban Meyer handled information regarding domestic violence, and we are disappointed in the way, and because of that, we believe it's time to move on. And because of the dishonesty he showed throughout the process, we're forced to move on. And instead they said, Urban Meyer kind of screwed up, but ultimately it's okay. And here's three games. He's still part of our family. To me, I don't know that necessarily squares with me. Like, that doesn't make sense to me fully. I think through this process, Urban Meyer comes out of this looking bad because of how, like, remove the domestic violence allegations from the equation for just a second here.
Which is tough.
But I want to look at this in a vacuum of who Zach Smith was based on everything else other than domestic violence. And based on everything else, Zach Smith is not a hireable football coach.
Right.
He's not a guy you want on your staff. And Urban Meyer has known Zach Smith since he was in college, and he's been a coach on Zach Smith has coached under Urban Meyer for the better part of the last 9 years. Like, he's coached basically 7 of the last 9 years, 10 years. So that he was willing to have a coach that has such poor judgments on his staff, I think, is the biggest damning aspect of this Urban Meyer deal. And I think it's very hypocritical of Urban Meyer, given all the rhetoric that he produces about core values. Now, that said, those things, minus the domestic violence again, don't necessarily, I don't think, again, this all depends on what the investigation found and what Urban Meyer can be proved to have known. I don't think those things are fireable. I think ultimately what this boils down to, though, what is fireable is the domestic violence allegations, how things were handled there. And I think ultimately, if you really look at this and you look at what Ohio State's saying and you look at what Urban Meyer's saying, and I'll get to the statement and the apology, quote unquote, in a minute. But ultimately, if you read between the lines here, Ohio State is saying we don't believe Courtney Smith. Now, you can say that's defensible or not. I'm not saying I agree with that or not. I'm just saying that's what Ohio State is saying, is we don't believe because if you believe the allegations, if you believe that Zach Smith was abusing Courtney Smith and that if the allegations are legitimate, then you have to believe that in some capacity Urban Meyer knew about that. And at that point, it is in the position he's in, he's called to act on that. And he didn't. So to me, that's what this sort of this gets down to. That is, Ohio State and Urban Meyer are saying, without saying it, and as close as they can possibly do without saying it, is we believe Zach Smith's version of these events over Courtney Smith's, and therefore Urban Meyer is, we'll let him continue to coach our program because he's going to win football games, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is. To me, there were fireable offenses for Zach Smith outside of the domestic violence. There was the relationship with multiple, and the fact that it was enabled, as when the report came out and we start to get into the details of what the investigation found about Zach Smith in particular, it unfortunately painted a picture where even when I was trying to be as sympathetic to Urban Meyer, as a thought experiment, I was like, okay, so let's put myself in his head and let's try and see, how he could have misread or mishandled this situation. And it just saddens me to think that Zach Smith had so much wrong. I mean, famously, Barton Simmons called him a turd. No one has described him more applicably. He is a turd, but it's like there was so much going on that I wonder if even the most hurtful actions, which were violence, alleged violence against Courtney Smith, that if that almost just got knocked down, or whether it was there was just like an oversaturation of bad Zach Smith either stories or allegations. And that speaks to, number one, Urban Meyer just not getting it. He just is not in tune with what matters. And that's my big takeaway here, because he was probably like, yeah, Zach's a troubled kid, but I believe in him. And that's like the way that relatives or someone will talk about a kid or a cousin, and there might be a long list of troubles, and one could be way worse than the other, but because there is a long list, it's just all getting thrown under the umbrella of, oh, he's just a troubled kid. And the inability to recognize the hurt that Zach Smith was causing to another human being and to continue to enable him for so long, I think that is a very damning criticism of Urban Meyer. It makes any time that he tries to preach any of his character messages, he has lost all credibility on that standpoint. And I see him as someone who has spent so much time insulated in college football. He understands college football, but I'm not sure he's as much of the great human being, understander, communicator as he's tried to make himself out to be.
Well, look, Urban Meyer comes out of this thing looking terrible because ultimately, and I think in this, all of his own doing. I mean, the way he handled Big Ten Media Days, and then he had an opportunity here in his response to these findings and to this ruling to salvage some of the integrity here by just being
apologetic. Just
apologetic.
Just be apologetic.
Being like, I always use this word, but like being a little bit authentic, and maybe authentic is just sort of a, maybe that doesn't mean anything to her. Maybe the authentic Urban Meyer is this like win robot, right? And so that's why he's a great coach. But our boy Will Brinson had a great tweet, and a lot of people sort of dance around this too. But like, you know, Brinson tweeted, "Just watch the full Urban Meyer statement apology. He sounded like a 15-year-old being grounded for smoking. He mumbled his way through it and clearly looked annoyed at being disciplined. What a sham." It's right. Like, that was a clearly – that statement that he made, the prepared statement where he read from a piece of paper, was clearly a, "I am pissed off that I'm disciplined here. There's no reason I should be suspended. I'm going to stand up here and I'm going to read this statement. I'm going to apologize to Buckeye Nation, but doggone it, this is ridiculous." And he still doesn't get that he screwed up here and that this is this is his fault.
Right.
He could have got rid of Zach Smith, like, regardless. Again, like, even if he doesn't believe and he feels that the allegations against Zach Smith are unfounded and false, he should have gotten rid of Zach Smith. Like, that's not debatable. He should have gotten rid of Zach Smith at several different points, and he kept him, and now this has all fallen at his feet, and this is the bed he made. And he was pissed off that he had to apologize. And like, just go up there and say, and again, I'll steal this idea from Bruce Feldman, who tweeted this. Like, just speak generally about domestic violence. Speak generally about how important that problem is right now and how seriously it needs to be taken. And how this needed to be something that was addressed differently, and that he handled things poorly, and say, "I've made, you know, like, just be," and rip up the paper and just talk, and he didn't do that, and it's just another. I just think you can throw, like, look, you can say Urban Meyer is the greatest coach of all time, and he is one of them, but you just you know, all the core value stuff is worth milch at this point. Like, it's just, it doesn't resonate at all with the Urban Meyer that has been presented to us by Urban Meyer over the last 2 months.
Here is Urban Meyer's response when asked if he had a message for Courtney Smith.
"What message do you have for Courtney Smith?"
"Well, I have a message for everyone involved in this. I'm sorry that we're in this situation. And I'm just sorry we're in this situation."
Are you kidding me?
I know. Like, you know you're going to get asked that, man.
Are you, like, you kidding
know,
like, me?
Of all the questions, you know you're going to get
that
asked
was that. The low point for me. I mean, and that's why I said, yeah. Like, I feel like we can hit on the press conference. We can hit on the fallout. You know, we can hit on what does this mean for the team? But like the press conference was as damning as the report to me, because Ohio State looked completely unapologetic to the situation that Courtney, to a human being, was in, when they had an opportunity to at least intervene a little bit more, you know?
Yeah. And again, like, I think people are attacking Urban Meyer for not sort of expressing sympathy to and for Courtney Smith. And I think what Urban Meyer did there in that statement, again, like, he, that is his way of saying, as clearly as he can without actually saying it, "I don't believe Courtney Smith is a victim." And look, whether you believe that or not, Urban Meyer, like, that's not the way to respond to that question.
Yeah.
It just makes you kind of wonder, like, all right, like, as smart as this guy is, like, how can you have that poor judgment?
The ultimately, I think that they started with a result and then they tried to figure out the way to line everything together. Like they, like, cause you mentioned, you said the suspension feels like some kind of compromise between firing a coach that Ohio State was not wanting to fire and just totally letting him off the hook, which is what Urban Meyer wanted. And they just, they had to figure out some way to connect the dots. And there's a couple of troubling things in the report. There is a phrase which acknowledges that, or, and again, the report acknowledges, this is not Chip Patterson or this podcast acknowledging, the report acknowledges and makes a point to say that Urban Meyer has difficulty remembering things with which he once had extensive knowledge, and also mentions that Urban Meyer was consulted on how to adjust his cell phone so that text messages from longer than a year ago are no longer kept and deleted. And when he handed his phone over to investigators, there was no record of messages beyond a 1-year length. That to me says that this isn't over. And those details to me suggest that all Urban Meyer has done with his defiancy is opened himself up to increased scrutiny that might not catch up to him for a year and a half or 2 years. But that like borderline, that cleaning, those acts of cleaning up your tracks stink to me.
Yeah, like that's the, let me ask you this. Cause this is, let's ask you this. Do you think he, like when you see the findings of this or the results and the punishment, like do you disagree? Like, do you think he should have been fired? And obviously we don't know, I mean, we can read the report, but we don't know the details. But do you believe that he should have been fired?
I think, yes. How about this? If his name is not Urban Meyer with a national championship and two more to his name and a $38 million buyout, I think he is fired.
Well, yeah, the $38 million buyout
if it's just
certainly factors in.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. Like, if it's just the actions, like if that's what you're saying, if it's just the information in the report, I think I'll go as far to say this. There's 129 head football coaches in FBS. I think 121 of them, if not more, would have been fired.
Right. So given what we know about – given what we know, like I don't – I'm sitting here and I'm sort of disappointed in Urban Meyer, but I don't – I'm not – I don't think he should have been fired in the legal sense, right? Like if –
But you don't have to break a law to be fired.
No, you don't. But again,
that would be the university saying our integrity is worth $38 million. We will pay $38 million to make a statement by saying that this behavior and this enabling is not acceptable for the leader of our football program.
Right. Right. And so I think where I'm at, and that's a fair point. I think where I'm at is given the $38 million buyout. Given the positive impact that Urban Meyer has had on the campus and on the program, because look, I'm not going to sit here and deny the fact that he has made an effort to, you know, really push off the field life after football stuff. I don't necessarily think he should have been fired. Like, I'm okay with him not being fired based on what we know to be true. And I think it's defensible. I think ultimately what it boils down to for me is, like, I just come away with a much lower opinion of Urban Meyer as a person. And I just think the way he reacted to things throughout the process, whether it was trying to cover his tracks and text messages, whether it was his response, you know, his statement after the rulings were found last night, whether it was his answer to that question about Courtney Smith, whether it was, you know, Big Ten Media Days. Every step of the way, Urban Meyer looks worse to me as a person. Like, I would be less inclined to send my son to play for Urban Meyer.
Right.
You know, so, but what does that mean that he, from a legal standpoint, like, again, I'm kind of looking at it from a legal standpoint. It's tough to put myself in the shoes of Ohio State president and board, but from a legal standpoint, I don't necessarily think a firing was merited. And I don't know, they could have fired him with cause, but I'm just sort of disappointed in Urban Meyer.
It's also like, this is a good point. You know, we're saying this from Nashville and Raleigh. Things are very different in Columbus, and the messaging was, you know, us against the world, batting down the hatches. And I would be a fool to think that that doesn't extend to university leaders and decision makers. National outrage won't fire a coach if the local scene is still behind him. And I think a lot of the people that would have had to pony up the money to get Urban Meyer out of there had no interest in trying to find a new football coach after Urban Meyer.
Do you think that there is an Ohio State fan, just a average fan anywhere, that was hoping Urban Meyer would get fired?
No.
I kind of don't think so either. And I don't know that that's – and look, there might be one or two. But in most of these situations, there is at least some level of division within the fan base. I would be surprised if anybody in the Ohio State fan base, given what we know, wanted Urban Meyer fired. So to that point, given that the Ohio State fan base is going to welcome him back, given that he's probably going to keep on winning a lot of games, I'm curious sort of what the lasting impact here will be, whether this will be forgotten 8 games in the year next year, or whether this will just continue to be a black cloud over Urban Meyer indefinitely. I that's really a hard for me to envision. I don't know. Do you have a take on that?
I mean, just from the media standpoint, I think that this has opened him up to just make everyone's going to dig. Like, he better be running everything crystal clean, like above the board or as much as you can, because I think that as if Urban Meyer didn't have enough enemies out there, there are going to be efforts that are made to double check everything by people who believe he got away with one here.
Right.
And that's, you know, it's tough to run everything completely clean. Right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. But yeah, I mean, hey, this is certainly his last strike, you know? I mean, I don't know. I mean, the guy's going to keep winning.
All right, so let's take this recruiting impact TBD, but your hunch is that, you know, he's going to keep on recruiting the top players in the country. Ohio State's going to have a good class pretty much every single year.
I think so. I mean, he's as good as there is in the country as a head coach recruiter. That's the reason that they're successful in recruiting is they have a good staff. Don't get me wrong. But the reason that Ohio State is so dominant in recruiting is because they have one of the best two or three head coach recruiters in the game. And he's going to be as motivated ever to continue that. I think, obviously, there is an Achilles heel now that's emerged. There is a chink in the armor that opposing programs can really lean on and a pressure point they can push on. How long that extends beyond this, we'll see. Like, I don't expect any of their current class to defect. So I don't know. And it's just very, like, they're going to recruit at a high level. And does that mean that this drops them from contending to number one to contending for top five? I mean, that's still a drop. So in that sense, hey, maybe it does have an impact, but ultimately, while there may be a player or two that is influenced by this, or a family or two, generally my expectation is that winning will take care of things, and there won't be much of an across the board drop off.
All right, what about on the field for this year? He will not be on the sidelines for the first 3 games. He will take part in the game planning for week 2 and week 3, which does include that big matchup against TCU. So Ryan Day will be the interim coach for those three games. Are you changing your expectations at all for what you're expecting to see from Ohio State?
I mean, my expectation has been that I think I was a little bit lower on Ohio State than others. Like, I kind of see 10-2 and not winning the East. I don't know that I think I still think they'll beat TCU, I guess. Does this help TCU ever so slightly? Yeah. And in a game of inches, as we say, I think TCU's could beat Urban Meyer before all this mess. And now they certainly, that doesn't hurt their chances. So I think my answer, though, is that this will not have a profound impact on the outcome of their season. They're going to be what they are with Ryan Day at the head coach. If Ryan Day was the head coach the whole year, that wasn't going to have a significant
They were going to win 10 games. If Ryan Day, if Urban Meyer was fired and Ryan Day was the head coach for the entire season, they were going 10-2.
Right.
Yeah, too good. And not to mention, and this is something that came out, I don't mean to say it like came out like it, but it was brought up as a point here. Like, Ryan Day had NFL OC offers. Ryan Day might have had the opportunity to go get a head coaching job this past coaching cycle. So this is a great opportunity for him. I mean, you don't hate to find any upside in a story that can be this grim and dismal, but if there is one, you're looking at Ryan Day, a coach on the rise who's got a big opportunity right here. And based on him being he played for Chip Kelly at New Hampshire, he's sort of been coming up, he's been tapped, he gets passed along to all the good offensive head coaches. I would still expect, even if Ryan Day had been the interim for the whole season, the team's too good to think that the bottom's going to fall out and this is going to be like the Luke Fickell 6-6 year. It's just not happening.
Look, I think Ryan Day, you look at what Lincoln Riley did at at Oklahoma, I think that Ryan Day is considered by some to be that kind of a rising star. So if Ryan Day, if you just hand him the keys, there, I think that there is Lincoln Riley. How should I phrase this? Like,
the path is there. There's like a
there's like a Lincoln Riley scenario in play.
Yeah,
and so to that point, like I don't think anybody should be sort of crying any tears for Ohio State because they gotta survive the Ryan Day 3-game tenure.
But you know what last night had me going to bed thinking?
What?
I think Michigan's going to win that game.
Yeah, man. We'll talk to Lorenz about Michigan here shortly. I've made my Michigan beliefs known. I am terrified of picking Michigan because they could lose week one and it'll all come crashing down. But yeah, this is another situation. Like, Michigan ain't crying for Ohio State right now. They'll take what's going on.
I mean, and like, it's Harbaugh's naming his quarterback. He's holding open practices. Like, Ohio State, because of the scandal, has totally iced the media out. And Harbaugh's like more than happy to play the other side of the coin in this situation.
Right. He's got to just be loving this. There's such a magnifying glass on him, and right now he's just sitting in the cut, just practicing with Shea Patterson, trying to get the wheels greased up. He's got to be just drinking milk, like double shots of milk every night right now.
I mean, at the risk of oversimplifying again, what is a very complex, disappointing, and sad situation at Ohio State, comparing those two rivals right now, it's like they're siblings and one of them is getting lectured at the table while Jim Harbaugh's doing the dishes and sweeping the floor. Like,
that's a great comparison. That's exactly what's
happening. No, guys, don't get up. I got this. I'll go get the dishes started.
Yeah. Harbaugh's in there watching cartoons while Urban's got to like mop the floor and do the dishes because he screwed up today.
Yeah. Yes. Oh man. All right. You ready to go around the world?
Let's go around the world, brother.
Around the world, around the world.
And we turn our attentions to Baton Rouge and the LSU Tigers, and who else to go to than the man, Shea Dixon, 24/7 Sports. Shea, we got to start with the one position that has been troublesome for LSU in terms of being able to be truly threatening offensively. It is the quarterback position, but they've got somebody in Joe Burrow coming from Ohio State. What is your belief? And this can be two different answers if you want. What is your belief in terms of what Joe Burrow can be for LSU? And then also, you know, maybe after that, do the coaches believe in him as well?
Yeah, I think, Chip, the coaches are at a point where they're going to have to believe in him. With Miles wow. Brennan, the only other scholarship quarterback on roster, Burrow's going to be the guy this year. And, you know, when I look at player comps, if we're just sticking with LSU, I think that he's probably a guy with a little more upside, obviously, but a Danny Etling type, or at least right now to where Danny was last year, a guy who really controlled the game with how he operated from under center and didn't turn the ball over much. And when I look at Burrow, Chip, I look at a guy who in high school was Mr. Ohio, and he had a 9.2-to-1 touchdown to interception ratio. He was a 68% passer in high school. In the spring games at Ohio State, he was in the high 60s as a passer, and in the college games he played, he was in the 70s as a passer. So that's an uptick from where LSU's been with in recent years at quarterback. So I think that right away they want him to be a guy who maybe has a year similar to Zach Mettenberger in his first year when, you know, he didn't blow up that first year playing, but it was his second year where he really shined. And I think we saw that a bit with Stidham last year, right? Maybe this is a similar situation to where there are high expectations and you'll see some hiccups at times, but he could go into the following year in 2019 as one of the more talked about quarterbacks in the conference. So he's not there yet. I think that they want to really just make sure that he can manage the game for him, and more so than ever, which will be interesting, I think that they're going to really throw the football, and we've heard that time and again with LSU, but Steve Ensminger is the offensive coordinator now, and he's gone to this kind of shotgun RPO attack, so much different from Matt Canada's jet sweeps and Les Miles' I formations. And I think for me, it boils down to they didn't only go get Burrow because they needed someone who could throw the ball around and feel comfortable about a guy who was already 21 years old and had been in a college program, but they don't really have a bell cow running back, and they've been so used to that. And because of that, they're going to have to move the ball around to one of their more talented groups on offense, which is the wide receivers. And two guys we ranked as 5 stars on 24/7 Sports, Terrace Marshall and Jamar Chase, will probably both be in the starting lineup when they play Miami. And Jonathan Giles, obviously from Texas Tech, and Justin Jefferson, who is the third Jefferson to play at LSU, Jordan and Ricky's younger brother. Those are the four guys I circle that will be their most productive receivers this year. And this team will probably go at least offensively as far as those four guys at Burrow can take them.
So that's a good, honest answer. And yet that doesn't exactly leave me super stoked about this offense. You're not like waving the flag that like Joe Burrow is going to come in and be some savior, which leads, I think, to the next question. All right, well, how steep is this drop off at running back? Because if you're sitting here saying, okay, Joe Burrow's good player, but maybe this is year one in like a 2-year progression for him, then you got to lean on that running back or that run game a little bit. And the big names aren't there. So help me get a grip on where the run game is and what kind of talent is in that backfield for the first time in a long time, but there's not a no-brainer first rounder.
Yeah, I mean, there isn't a or a no-brainer that you know will play in the NFL with not even a Fournette or Geist or Darrell Williams or Jeremy Hill or Alfred Blue, Spencer Ware. You could go down the line of guys they've had that weren't Fournette or Geist but were still really high-level running backs. They don't have that, at least not proven. So Clyde Edwards-Helaire will be their starter. For me, he's a lot better. Look, we had him as a top 247 guy. We weren't sleeping on him, but he's a 5'8 kid, and we weren't sure if he would ever be an every down back. And I think there'll be a committee approach because of it. But he's their lead guy. He played some as a freshman last year. He catches the ball well out of the backfield, which I think they'll do a good bit of this fall. So he's your number one guy. But your number two and three guys, you're in this position, Barton, where Nick Brissett's a senior now. And I can remember in high school, he went through 10th and 11th grade with everyone wondering, was it Geis or Brissett being the better back? And ultimately, Geis, you know, finishes the higher ranked back and certainly had the better college career. So they're waiting for Brissett, who's a very patient runner. That's the best way to describe him, to really have that breakthrough season. And if it's not him, look out for Chris Curry. This is a kid who is a true freshman. They knew they were going to have to recruit some guys to play after missing on Cam Akers and Travis Etienne and some others. And Curry was, I believe he was a top 10 running back on 24/7 Sports last year coming out of Florida. And they really like his physical running style, kind of compare him in ways to Marshawn Lynch. That's who he models his game after. He's very much a between the tackles, pinball type of runner. And they're going to put him sort of baptism by fire. They want to play him early. And if Brissett, you know, if he's not able to answer the call, I think they feel good about Edwards Elair. But if Brissett's not able to deliver at the level they're used to, they're going to be playing Curry a good bit. But I don't think we see this year. Look, we got so used to Fournette, 27 touches a game. Geis, 25 touches a game. This will be a committee approach where I would bet Clyde Edwards Elair, through catching the ball or running it, will touch it 15 or 16 times a game. And then they'll get Brissett and Curry involved. But more so than ever, because they don't have a real answer there, they're going to have to move the ball around, which is why I think that they were excited about being able to go out and get Joe Burrow, because they feel confident that he can at least manage a game and be careful with the football. And certainly, as the son of a defensive coordinator at the college level and all his brothers played at Nebraska, he's got a high football IQ. He knows what's needed for this offense to work. And it's going to go through him. They're not going to be able to sit back and just run the ball this season, at least not in the traditional sense that we've been used to with LSU football.
Shay Dixon at Shay Dixon on Twitter. Go 247.com. Shay, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Around the world, around the world.
And now we go to Austin, to Horns 247 and Jeff Howe covering Texas Longhorns. You've been on this show before. You've given us incredible insight. And we don't, at this point, have to talk about a quarterback competition because Tom Herman has already named Sam Ellinger as the starting quarterback for week one against Maryland. So I guess we can go big picture offense, Jeff. How do you feel like we will see some changes, or what are your expectations for the next step in the evolution of this Longhorns offense with Ellinger at the quarterback position?
Well, Sip, you know, I think it's going to be better, but I guess better is a relative term. You know, you look at the offensive line, for example. You know, if Texas is below average this year, that's a pretty big step forward from abysmal, which is what Texas was last year, especially when Connor Williams was out of the lineup. And I think, you know, when you look at – and I think when you talk about this offense, I think that's where it starts. It starts up front. And with Calvin Anderson, Tom Herman's already given him kind of the starting left tackle spot, unless something, you know, crazy happens between now and kickoff at FedEx Field on September 1st. But with Calvin Anderson at left tackle, Patrick Vahey at left guard, Zach Shackelford at center, Elijah Rodriguez at right guard, and then if Derek Kerstetter holds off Sam Cosmi and wins the right tackle job, you've got 98 combined career starts at the FBS level between those five offensive linemen and a left side of the offensive line with Vahey and Anderson. That should be a strength for you. So I think to me, the ceiling for this Texas offensive line, I think if they can get to average, which I think is the best case scenario, you're miles ahead of where you were last year. I think with the running game, I think they've got three backs that they actually like. I think with Danny Young, Trey Watson, the grad transfer from Cal, and then Keontae Ingram, who, you know, I think next year, maybe the year after, once he's spent some time in the strength program and his body molds itself a little bit, you'll be able to see some noticeable differences. But I think just the juice he brings to that position, understanding the nuances of the passing game the way he does, very high football IQ kid. I think they like their three backs. The wide receiver position underperformed last year, but they made some changes in the offseason there. And then you bring it back to quarterback. And I think if Sam Ellinger, I think the big question with Sam Ellinger is this: the mistakes he made last year, were those freshman mistakes that with a year to learn the offense, a year to process film, a year to really understand the position, do some of those go away, or do we see those same mistakes? He's still going to make those mistakes because all young quarterbacks do, but does he cut down on some of those turnovers, and is Texas in a better position to go close out some games, because they were pretty much in every game they played last year?
All right, so this question will be a little more big picture in a way, and I guess it speaks to your expectations, but also I'm just curious, what's the fan base's expectation? Like, what will this fan base tolerate in terms of record by the end of this year? Because we all, like, every year we're talking about, is this going to be the breakout year for Texas? And it seems like they always show signs and then kind of disappoints. And like, does this team have to go 9-3? Is 7-5 just totally unacceptable? Like, what is the fan base's expectation, and how does that jive with I think reality and a realistic expectation?
You know, Barton, it's interesting. I think the roles have almost reversed. If you look at the end of the Mack Brown era, I think everybody in Austin around this program, the fan base, they were almost kind of waiting to say, okay, surely, you know, yeah, last year was bad, but surely this is the year where they're going to win 10 or 11 and be in the mix for the Big 12 title. And it never happened. And I think the roles are almost reversed. It almost feels like the national media can feel it, that Texas, okay, at some point they're going to turn it around. And I think locally, just being around the program, being in Austin, the pulse of the fan base, it's like, look, I mean, we're a long way away from predicting that 10 or 11 win season. I think last year was a good step. And I don't think anybody was happy with 6-6. But yeah, I think the good step for this program, this shows you just how bad it got under Charlie Strong. The fact that they were in every game in the fourth quarter with the chance to win was a really big step in the right direction. And I think when you look back at last year, you know, had they not had just an awful, you know, quarter and a half in the middle of the Maryland game and kind of fell asleep at the wheel in the fourth quarter of the Texas Tech game, they're an 8-win team in the regular season last year. So I think if they're 8-4, and I said this last year, 8-4 was going to be a really good record for that team. I think the same thing this year. I think 8-4, and I think if they get to 8 in the regular season with the chance to finish with 9 in a bowl game, that's something you can sell to the fan base, because I think an 8-win Texas team, that means you beat a USC, an Oklahoma, a TCU, somebody of that ilk, to where, you know, Tom Herman can hang his hat on having a signature win. I think, Barton, to me, that's the big thing. It's not necessarily the win total per se, but I think if you're 8-9 with a bowl game and one of those wins is one of those signature victories that can kind of really, that the fan base can really get behind, then I think that'll make everybody feel like this thing is headed in the right direction.
Wow, you're right. National media is way higher on Texas than local. Everyone's looking at Ellinger, and we're just excited. I think I'm out here on this podcast. It sounds like I might be making a fool of myself, thinking that Sam Ellinger can make a run at Big 12 Offensive Player of the Year.
Chip, we've talked each other into Ellinger, man. We are leading the Ellinger fan club.
Jeff's just put, man. So is that off?
No, I don't think you guys are necessarily wrong on Sam Ellinger when you just look at the landscape of Big 12 quarterbacks. I mean, outside of Will Grier, you know, who do you really trust? I mean, you know, we think it's going to be plug and play with Kyler Murray at Oklahoma. Do you trust Kyle Kemp at Iowa State? One of the two kids at K-State that's going to win that job. Now, I think Sam Ellinger's got really just as good a chance as anybody to be the number two or three quarterback in this league. But again, I think it just goes back with him. There were just so many just egregious mistakes he made at times last year. It's were those just freshman mistakes that he's going to grow out of? Or now do we really start to see a more mature football player who's able to take care of the ball, manage situations better? And if he just does that, I think that's going to make the difference in two or three of those games that were, you know, fourth quarter, last possession type games last year.
Jeff Howe, Horns 247. You can follow him on Twitter at Jeff Howe 247. Jeff, thank you very much, sir.
Anytime, guys.
And we have landed in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where Steve Lorenz is right there with all the information that we need on the Michigan Wolverines. Steve, let's take some deep breaths, and let's talk about the football aspects of the Big Ten and the Big Ten East right now. When Shea Patterson was named the starting quarterback, a couple of things stood out to me. Number one, it was going contrary to what I had become used to with Jim Harbaugh, who had loved to, you know, keep all of that information so close to the point where, you know, we're waiting to see which quarterback has taken snaps before the season opener. And so, you know, I was wondering aloud if maybe this was as much a move for the team in the locker room. And so I want to pose this to you. What is your, from your vantage point, how has Shea Patterson assimilated into the Michigan football culture?
I think he's assimilated really well. because he's good. That's one okay. thing. I think these are a group of players that know that this is a year that could possibly be a big one for them. And so I think they want the best possible option under center. He's it. I think Harbaugh naming him the starter early, as you said, it's out of character for him. I think that's significant that he did so. I mean, they're even holding an open practice on Sunday at Michigan Stadium. I mean, it's like a bizarro world right now as far as preseason type stuff for them goes. I mean, this is way out of the ordinary. To me, I think it's an indication that Jim Harbaugh is really comfortable with the team. I think they like where they're at heading into South Bend. And Patterson's obviously a big piece of that. He's had a great fall camp from everything we know. I think we all could agree he was probably going to be the guy regardless, barring something maybe significant. I know Barton's always been high on Brandon Peters.
Always.
I think Brandon Peters has a bright future, you know. But I still think that Patterson was probably going to be the guy, barring some unforeseen situations there. So, I think it's a definitely an indication that the locker room's behind him. I know Tariq Black had a lot of great things to say about his leadership ability, his work ethic, and his command in the huddle during his availability earlier this week. So, I think if you're a Michigan fan, that's great news that they've already named him publicly. Again, I think it's the first time Harbaugh's done that since he did with Andrew Luck and back at Stanford. I don't even know if he did it in the NFL. I could be wrong there. But as far as college goes and at Michigan, this is a new thing for him to do that. I think it speaks to where they think this season could go.
So, obviously, the quarterback position was one that needed to be figured out. But really, if you look at the Michigan roster, there's really only one other sort of question mark, and that's offensive line. So I'm curious, as the season approaches, how confident are you in an improved offensive line? Where do you think that they're at? Like, what are the ingredients here and the aspects at play that you're kind of paying attention to in terms of like what this offensive line will be this fall?
Well, I think the interior is strong. I think they have four really good players in the interior with Cesar Ruiz in the middle. I think he's a potential all Big Ten level player this year. He was great as a true freshman last year. Ben Bredesen is a guy, has been a mainstay. It's his third year as a starter, but really actually maybe the guy who has responded best to the Ed Warner addition at the offensive line coach spot is a guy I think is really going to take off this year again, but has been a quality player for them for 2 years. And then at right guard, you know, there's an ongoing battle between Michael Onwenu and Steven Spinellis, who, again, I think Spinellis is their sixth best offensive lineman, or whoever loses that battle, I suppose, would be number six and would probably be first in at any of the interior spots if somebody else goes down. I think in the interior, I think they're pretty solid. I think the questions are at tackle, where they sort of have been. I think Mason Cole was always really good, never great. I don't know if they have that at this point. John Runyon Jr. is the guy that we have pegged at left tackle. The one thing about him, he was the top performer. They did their spring camp, sort of like a combine style workout, and they released those numbers publicly. Runyon was like at the top at every one of those categories. So the athleticism with him is definitely there. I think it's a matter of, has the light gone on for him? I know he had a great spring, and it sounds like he's continued it with a great fall. And on the right side, that's another battle too. I think James Hudson, the redshirt freshman out of Toledo, I think we had him graded as a defensive lineman. Michigan moved him to offensive line last year. He'd be my pick right now just because that battle's so close between him and Juwan Bushel-Beatty. I think they would probably go with youth there and upside, I would imagine. I mean, that's what I would do, but you know, they're obviously going to try to put the best five out there. So really, to me, the interior, I think, is going to be pretty strong. I think it's up to the tackle position. I know Barton would like to hear. I think Jalen Mayfield is contended at left tackle, too. I think Runyon will definitely be the starter, but Mayfield has come in and impressed right away as well. I know we had him a lot higher than the composite did. So I think it's kind of a situation where I think the depth and the youth is finally starting to build there. But tackle is going to be a question mark, I think. Might be some growing pains there. Maybe another reason why Patterson is such a natural fit for them as a guy who can get out of the pocket and make plays, you know, if the pocket does break down. So, but again, the other thing too, Ed Warner has been a great addition. Not heard one bad word about what he's done. I think simplification has been like the buzzword of the offseason on the offensive line, simpler schemes. I think under Tim Drevno, I think things were sometimes so overly complicated that even the veteran linemen didn't really know maybe what was going on at all times, amazingly enough. So I agree, though. I think, you know, the receivers struggled last year, but I think that there's going to be a huge step up from multiple guys there. So I agree with Barton that the offensive line is probably still the big question mark. And I think it's on the outside more than the inside where that question is going to remain.
Do you have a game pick for Notre Dame yet?
I think they're better than Notre Dame. It's just the question is they haven't won a game on the road of this magnitude. And since I went to Michigan, that was like 10, 12 years ago. I mean, it's been forever since they've won a big game on the road. But I do think the advantage, I think their defense against Notre Dame's offense, there'd be a bigger gap than vice versa. Is going to take a couple steps forward this year. I have them winning, by a touchdown, maybe like a 21-14 type game or something along those lines.
Yeah, so, that's what I'm thinking. Let's go 20-13, 21-14. Let's keep it low. All right, is Steve Lorenz. You can follow him on Twitter at TremendousUM, Michigan 24/7 Sports. Thank you so much.
Yep, thanks, guys.
To Athens, Georgia, where we're going to be discussing the Georgia Bulldogs, and there is no one else on the planet that I would rather have in to discuss the Dogs than Rusty Mansell. You can follow him on Twitter at Mansell247. Rusty, the Georgia practiced the Georgia football program under Kirby Smart. You know, it's hard to get information out of there, and the vibes around this program are very positive, coming off the SEC championship and the runner-up appearance in the college football playoff. So I want to maybe ask something that only you could pull out. You know, everyone's so excited, but I think there's a lot of unanswered questions. Where on the football field are you pointing to as a potential weakness, or if not a weakness, an area where Georgia has to be really good or improved in order to repeat the success of last season?
Well, you know, I'll answer that in two ways. I think Georgia's roster is probably as good as it's ever been that I've really have followed them. I think this number one recruiting class in 2018, you know, brought these bodies in, these athletes, these guys. Barton, I think, would agree with this. Some questions that are never answered until the season gets going. My biggest concern at covering this team is who are the leaders? I mean, when you lose guys like Nick Chubb, Sony Michel, Roquan Smith, Davin Bellamy, and Lorenzo Carter, not only were those guys that were been in the program for 4 years, Roquan three, those were clear leaders of that team. You look at the big plays they made last year, Davin Bellamy, Notre Dame, Lorenzo Carter, Rose Bowl, Sony Michel, National Championship game, go on and on, Roquan, that big hit against Oklahoma. Those guys not only did it on the field, but they were respected in the locker room. I think that was a lot of Georgia's success last year. My question is, who's going to be leaders? I think on the field, you look at who is going to replace, who's going to be that DB opposite of Baker, who is going to be that guy opposite DeAndre Baker. Tyree McGee, I thought, had a chance. He's hurt now. So will it be, you know, Mark Webb, who's a converted wide receiver, or will it be freshman Tyson Campbell, who Bart and I are very familiar with, who's a really, really good player, one of the fastest players probably in the country coming in out of high school. But, you know, there's some concerns on the field, but I think covering them, who is going to be that alpha that can stand up and have the respect in the locker room when things aren't going, and also when those coaches aren't around, who are those guys that are running that locker room? And that says a lot to what direction Georgia will go.
So you sort of touched on it a little bit in terms of some guys that need to fill some holes. But look, this you mentioned it. This is the number one recruiting class in the country. First time anybody's had that title in the last 7 years that's not named Alabama. Demetrius Robertson is also coming in now and immediately eligible. Where is there going to be an immediate impact from this group of newcomers? Because certainly there's plenty of guys that are capable, but where, based on what you're hearing in camp, have guys really flashed, and are guys ready to come out of the gates guns blazing?
I think the one guy I think has created the buzz, and me and you talked pretty good, I've kept you kind of in the loop on this, is James Cook, the freshman running back out of Miami. And look, we both saw him at the Army All-American game and weren't real quite sure if he was going to be going to Georgia, if he was going to be that guy that's going to run between the tackles and all that kind of thing and what you see out of Georgia. But I think what he has brought to the table sounds like a very, very – you talk about flashing. This is what this guy is doing. They're getting the ball in space, I heard. He's still fast all day during practice. I heard some of the GPS things, some of the rumors in GPS that he might be the fastest player at the end of practice in pads. And that's the science of today's game. But James Cook's a guy that I fully expect, especially with Zamir White going down, Georgia to have packages for him, do what he does best, kind of that Alvin Kamara role. You know, he might get 60 or 70 yards rushing, but he also might have 60 or 70 yards receiving and also return yards. So I think if you're looking for a true freshman that's going to be an instant impact, I think it's him. And I'll say this about Justin Fields. I have said the whole time that I think Jake Fromm is their guy. I think Jake Fromm is going to start. I think Jake Fromm is going to play the majority of the meaningful minutes for the Georgia Bulldogs. I will say this. I think that Justin Fields is going to be almost like what Tim Tebow did his freshman year when Chris Leak was their guy. They would bring him in that red zone area. Remember all those big plays he made? Sometimes he made those first downs on Wildcat. Sometimes he made those jump passes. Sometimes he made throws. So Justin Fields might not play 15 plays a game. He might just play 5 or 6 plays a game, but he's going to make an impact for Georgia Barton. Yeah, I know you're a big Justin Fields guy. I am as well. What he brings athletically is a problem for teams in Georgia. Even with a great player like Jake Fromm, they're going to find a way to get him in. So I think two guys on the offense are going to make immediate impact for Georgia, and that would be James Cook and Justin Fields.
Could James Cook be, because DeAndre Smith is now taking over as the true kind of carry the load back, yeah. Could he step into that role that DeAndre was in last year as that sort of maybe kind of jet sweep, kind of all-purpose type of guy that in the backfield? Because that was the thing we saw at the Army Bowl is, will he run between the tackles? I even said, like, I could see him being a wide receiver in 3 years. So he's got that versatility.
You know, gains weight. Yeah, I agree with you. And let me cut you off there. That, I agree. You know, there was a – me and you kind of laughed out, but there was a lot of discussion about what we did with his ranking. And the reason we did is because of that. We weren't James Cook, not James Cook fans. We just weren't sure how he's going to fit in the puzzle at Georgia. And I agree with you. You know, they got a lot of stuff to Miko Hardman last year, a lot of that jet sweep stuff. He already scored on the Wildcat against Alabama late, right before the half. I think you could see James Cook doing all that. I just think he's too talented. And again, you look at Alvin Kamara is 220 pounds now. So I'm careful there, but I know seeing him in high school, he was a 190 pound kid. And what he did was some of the same thing. He didn't have to have 160 yards a game rushing or 25 carries to impact you when you got that ability and that speed. So I think that's the way Georgia's going to use him, is they're going to create space. They're going to get him the ball. And they'll let DeAndre Swift and Elijah Holyfield get those 3, 4, and 5 tough yards in there. But I think that Georgia's going to use him. And what I'm hearing is he has been very successful in fall camp.
He is Rusty Mansell. You can follow him on Twitter at Mansell247, Dogs247. Rusty, you're the man. Thank you very much.
Thanks, guys, for having me.
I mean, we like to talk about players that are buzzing, but there's some boots on the ground that are buzzing. And it's Ryan Abraham at Inside Troy on Twitter, USCFootball.com. That's where you're going to find him. No one better to talk to about the Trojans than Ryan. So, Ryan, we got to start, of course, at the quarterback position. So I'm going to ask you. So if the floor is Heisman Trophy as a freshman and the ceiling is the greatest of all time, where exactly is JT Daniels in your mind right now?
Yeah, he is poised. We don't know yet, but he's poised to be the first true freshman to start for USC since Matt Barkley did it. And if you remember, you know, Matt Barkley went on the road and beat Ohio State. That was a great win, but it wasn't like a, you know, crazy great season as far as stats go. I kind of get the feeling JT Daniels will be in that category. They'll probably try to rely on his defense and run the football a little bit more. He should be able to manage the game. Now, we don't know yet. We saw our last practice before. They're going to have a mock game this weekend, which is closed. So we're not going to see this team until Tuesday. So it's weird. We're down there every day. But sometime over that span, I think Clay Helton's going to meet with all the quarterbacks and the team and let them know who's going to win. My guess is JT Daniels, but that's out of my pay grade to make those kind of calls.
All right. So given that you just confirmed that JT Daniels is the greatest quarterback of all time, the next logical question here, Ryan, is I am slowly but surely warming up to making a bold USC playoff prediction. I need you to tell me if I am just insane and just need to lay off the sauce, or whether you're like, you know what, like I see where you're coming from. Talk me off the ledge or push me over. Like, I just, where am I at here? Because I really think, like, when you look at if freshman quarterbacks can do this. We've seen it the last couple of years, and I've seen the way they've recruited. I know the talent that's bubbling up. So I'm curious how crazy you think I am and where you're at with that kind of expectation.
Well, Barton, I always think you're crazy, but in this case, it's different, I think. No, I mean, you saw him come in as, you know, a reclassified junior playing in the Army, you know, in the Army game stuff, and he looked as good as anybody out there. So I think you're not, you know, if he becomes the guy, you're not, you know, they have a good quarterback. You know, how long will it take him to kind of be a great college quarterback? I don't know. We'll see. Maybe it's right away. Maybe it's after a year or so. But this team is as deep on defense as I've seen since some of those Pete Carroll years. They really got bodies all over the place. A guy like Jay Tufele comes in, who was a five-star redshirted last year, and is just killing it now. So, I mean, there's a lot of guys like that, a lot of veterans, and then a lot of young players mixed in. And they got plenty of skill guys, and they have, you know, they're 15 deep or whatever on the offensive line. They got lots of guys returning there. The pieces are in place, Barton, that they could do like an 11-1 season and make the college football playoff. And the schedule, if you go through September undefeated, you're going to be one of the talked about teams in college football, because you'd have road wins against Stanford and Texas and Arizona with Khalil Tate and all that. So it's set up where if they win, they're going to do a good job, you know. But this is a team I think could finish 7-5 too. So I don't think it's not out of the realm of possibility that, you know, 11-1 and they make the college football playoff. But if they struggle early in September and they start off 1-2, who knows what they could do. So I think there's a wide range. So you're not crazy for thinking that, but just know that it might be a lot worse than that too.
They need to do is start 2-1. That's what if they start 2-1, then I'm golden. But here's what's going to cinch my prediction or have me just sort of call off the dogs here is your answer to the next question here. What are we to make of the offensive line? Are you confident that the offensive line will be a totally different unit than last year, or are we still worried about that group?
I think you'd still have to be somewhat worried about that group. Neil Callaway's back for his third year. The 6 years prior to Clay Helton, they had a different offensive line coach every year. So continuity was always a problem. Well, they have that now. They've got guys, I think six guys with starting experience, four, you know, regular starters returning, and that's 15 scholarship guys. There are plenty of 4- and 5-star dudes to choose from. There's experience. You have continuity. It should work, Bart. It should be good. And if it's not, then there's some other problems going on. So I'm not convinced that it will be, but it's set up that it should be. And if it's not, that's a huge problem Clay Helton's going to have to address.
What does your gut say for the you mentioned it could be 11-1, it could be 7-5. What are you seeing as you look into your crystal ball at what the record is going to be at the end of the year?
You know, I think it's fairly safe to say like 9-3. It's probably somewhere around there. You could see this team losing a game or two. I mean, they got some tough road games. Clay Helton hasn't lost in the Coliseum, so he hasn't lost at home. I mean, that's a good sign, I guess. But I don't know. You just feel like with a freshman quarterback and still a young coaching staff that's kind of learning on the job, that it's going to be tough to make that kind of run. They made a great run after starting off terrible in 2016. You know, maybe they have to do that again because they got that early part of the schedule. But my guess would be probably about 9-3.
He is Ryan Abraham. You can follow him on Twitter at InsideTroy. USCFootball.com is where you find his work. Ryan, thank you very much.
Anytime, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Around the world, around the world.
Well, that about wraps. That's it. I mean, that doesn't about wrap up. Barton, that was a very solid around the world in 30-ish minutes. What do you think you learned, or what is your takeaway from those five interviews we just had with the boots on the ground from 24/7 Sports?
interesting. Like, not a lot of confidence from LSU, I didn't feel like. Nope. Like, I don't leave the LSU conversation ready to start predicting 9-3. I don't leave the USC conversation with a whole lot of, like, additional ammo for my playoff run. I feel a little better about my Michigan playoff run, and Georgia is going to be Georgia. Texas is – it's the same Texas as it's been the past, like, 4 years. So, like, I thought it was really interesting. Like, that was a good run around the world. I'm glad we picked those five to start, because I feel like we learned a lot.
I'm going to say that the most significant takeaway is probably the most abstract, and the fact that Rusty went right to asking about the leaders in the locker room. I mean, I trust him to have a good feel for the personalities that are on that team. And a lot of times I think that, you know, other national media will have that kind of conversation, just, you know, looking at the fact that key players were gone and, you know, wonder aloud who's going to step up. But I'll be curious to revisit that, particularly because, man, you might need some leadership when you go on the road week 2 to take on South Carolina.
No question. And, yeah, I mean, everyone talks about, like, Roquan Smith and, what, you're losing 130 tackles or whatever the hell he had last year. But you're also losing that alpha dog leadership in the defensive locker room. And so it's going to be, like, that's – you can't quantify that. Like, you can't – you just don't – you don't really know what that looks like until the bullets start flying. So you're right. I think that was a pretty interesting thing to point to by him.
All right. He is Barton Simmons. You can follow him on Twitter @BartonSimmons. You can follow me @Chip_Patterson. It was a really busy week. We had some fun buzzing around with some camp buzz, talking about some news. We had the coaches episode with Bruce Feldman. Make sure that you subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, TuneIn, wherever you get your podcasts, you will be able to find it. Barton, thank you very much.
Next week, we're previewing real games.
We got locks coming up in a week.
Locks. Let's do it.